You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council. Oh, an evening of music awards. Do we need good grammar on the internet? YouTube's new music service, Festival Fever, the culture show reviewed, and two volcanic tracks are added to the pretend iPod.
Hello, hello. Welcome once again to the Parish Council. This is our podcast and it comes to you from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw and standing in the corner with his tracksuit off, he's Terence Dackham.
Hello.
I know nothing whatsoever, except Pelé's real name. I know nothing whatsoever about football, but I could have told you this was going to happen.
Oh, you could have done. By the way, hello, Magnus Shaw. Yeah, you could have done. It's all too inevitable. And now, as we record this on Friday, it's even deeper. We mentioned this last week. We're even deeper into the, well, if Italy can beat Costa Rica, and then if Italy can beat Uruguay, and then we can beat Costa Rica by this number of goals. Oh, God,
well,
you know
what? This is what completely befuddles me, because from what I can tell, you could actually win the World Cup by losing all your games. And just doing some maths on a tablecloth and say, hey, hold on, fellas, it looks like we've won.
I think that's actually the way that FIFA work. Yeah. I think that's the premise on which their whole setup is built. Now, Magnus Shaw, I know what you're thinking.
Yes.
I know what you've been thinking. I've read your thoughts. And I know what you most want in life. What you've been pining for is yet another set of annual awards.
Oh, Lord.
Yes, what this country is crying out for is another set of annual music awards. We already have the Brits, NME, Q, Mojo, Kerrang. I found 47 music awards in the UK when I did a little bit of research about this.
Wow.
Now, here comes the BBC. 37 years after the launch of the Brits, which were actually broadcast by the BBC until 1992 when they lost interest. So here we are, Magnus Shaw, hosted by Fern Cotton and also inevitably Chris Evans, live on BBC One 3 days before the BBC Sports Personality of the Year show in December. Have you already rushed to your diary and underlined the date? Thursday, 11th of December.
I think I was looking forward to the World Cup more than I was looking forward to this. how does this stuff get greenlit? I can't begin to imagine. I suppose they're particularly cheap to stage, aren't they, I guess? But that can be the only reason to stick them on. I don't think the Brits gets that much of an audience anymore, does it? I think the viewing figures in the ceremony not long since gone were quite shabby, weren't they? So why the BBC would want a bit of that action, I don't know. And then if that wasn't enough to, you know, make me despair, when you mention it's going to be hosted by Chris Evans and Fern Cotton, I think there's some kind of conspiracy to drive me to an early grave. All the obvious people will win. There'll be your Coldplays and and so on and so forth. Your Kings of Leon. I don't know. It won't be a great surprise. You know, they're not going to be giving a lifetime achievement a gong to Crispy Ambulance, are they?
No, they won't. No, it'll be people shouting and people trying to be funny. Pop stars who've had a couple of drinks trying to make funny remarks from a stage and getting overwhelmed by it all. And
masses and masses of industry people all on freebies, totally ignoring the events and just taking advantage of their expense accounts. I can't see any point in it whatsoever. Don't the BBC already cover the Mercury's anyway? Is that not sufficient?
They say that BBC One, Radio One, Radio Two and The One Show will all join together to network these awards from Earl's Court. And
oh, I see. Oh, OK, so all those channels get, a couple of hours of content, shared, split the bill, go Dutch on that. So that's
it's the sort of thing, it's our old problem, isn't it? It's the sort of thing that executives hidden away from reality and real life, sitting in their glass-walled rooms in New Broadcasting House, think is a good idea. Yeah. But in reality, you know, if there weren't all these other awards, as I say, 47 that I counted in existence.
I don't think there's even that many Hollywood award ceremonies.
No, it's ridiculous, yeah. Isn't it? I mean, it could be arguable that a show reflecting the previous year's music could be welcomed. But do we really need, you know, that? It's going to be a shouty Chris Evans, isn't it, hosting it? I mean, it looks like a copy of the Brits. But Here's a point that struck me overall about these things. You know, I find award ceremonies depressing because, you know, should the BBC be involved at all, is I suppose what I'm asking. Why do we have to vote that Adele is better than Kate Bush or that Kasabian are better than the Kaiser yeah. Chiefs? I mean, can't they all just do what they do?
No, that's my exact feeling. It's to mistake music for a competitive sport, isn't it?
It is. It's like a World Cup, yeah, isn't yeah. it, for musicians? Yeah, yeah. And you know, and because of the way these things are set up, and because all the voting panel. I mean, we had this thing on the Brits for years, didn't we? Where Annie Lennox, you know, who hadn't released a record for 10 yeah. years, you know, always pops up best female singer. Oh, you know, is it Kate Bush or Annie Lennox?
Yeah.
Neither of whom, you know, had put any content out for a decade.
No, that's right.
You know, it's just what these fellows, and I'm sure women, sitting in the ivory tower, think. Is what some sort of value,
yeah.
And it has none.
No, I agree. I'd rather see 2 hours of just. Well, I think they used to do this on New Year's Eve, didn't they? The year in music, you know, in review.
Yeah, that'd be all right. Yeah, that'd be fine.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be fine. Then they're not competing with each other, as you say. It's not an Olympics.
Somewhere on an old VHS, I've got a thing called Rock of the 80s. It's about 3 hours long, I think, something like that. They showed it on New Year's Eve 1989, and it was the decade in review, and it was great. I mean, I don't have a VHS player anymore, but I must get it transferred to DVD one day, because it was great. It was just 3 hours of this is everything we have enjoyed in the last 10 years and a few things we haven't, and it's really good. It's really interesting, and some intelligent comment, not scrolling across the bottom of the screen, but just in voiceover. But mainly, just have a look at these, you know, do you remember this stuff? And that's fine, I can go with that. It's, yeah, like you say, you know, toe-curling thank you speeches from the stage, plus witty asides from Fern Cotton to camera, I can well do without. God.
Well, I think we've both successfully ensured that we won't be getting an invitation now. I wouldn't go, honestly. In all seriousness, if they gave me a free pass to an executive table, I'd say nah, you're all right.
You're all right. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, well,
I'd say, meh.
We haven't seen it. It might be a triumph, but we are speculating wildly. But I think we have experience on our side.
Oh, I think so. This week, Magnus Shaw, on the website, Us Versus Them, a newish addition to the internet canon, the author John Higgs wrote an essay in which he argues that we shouldn't worry so much about typos and accuracy in written work, including the internet. He says, and here's a quote, "The obsession with doing things right leads to the belief that perfection is enough, that perfection is valid in itself," which is deliciously philosophical. He goes on, the belief that the world is a sensible, rational and ordered place is known as the aneuristic delusion. And that's not the sort of nonsense that we want our language to promote. Now, this fellow, John Higgs, he says mistakes are human and being human is good. So now I'm going to ask the panel if we should worry about errors and typos in written work. Who shall I turn to first? I'll turn to you, Magnus Shaw.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it does matter. I really don't buy into this thing of, language is an evolving beast, and therefore, you know, we must allow everything. I do, of course, acknowledge that language is an evolving beast. Read Geoffrey Chaucer in the original Middle English to see how far we've come. But that is not to say that illiteracy is the route to a healthy evolution of language, and that's what we're looking at. If somebody doesn't know the difference between two and two, then that's an illiterate error. Now, I don't disparage them as a human being for not having that knowledge. You know, the role education has to play in this is perhaps a chat for another day, but it doesn't mean I'm a bad human being, but it does mean there's a gap in their knowledge. So are we to say that ignorance is human and therefore we should celebrate it? Of course not. And I've given talks and presentations on this, and what I always do is just type a paragraph of random characters, just absolutely random characters, and ask somebody to read it out, which of course they can't. And I say, well, it's strange that you can't, because it's in perfectly good English. I just haven't used any spelling or grammar rules to write it. And that, you know, thereby making the point that if you don't apply some kind of standard, then you can't make sense of it. And the whole point of language and the whole beauty of language is its ability to capture something for posterity, to convey a meaning or an emotion or a sense or a thought or a proposition, succinctly and accurately. And if you're going to take all the rules away, then it loses the ability to do that. So it matters. Yeah, of course it matters.
I can't disagree with you. We all make mistakes, except me, of course. But I think it's a preposterous notion that we leave in our typos and errors to show we're human. And I was thinking, you know, if you're a mechanic and you notice that someone's brakes aren't working, you don't leave them broken as a sort of conversation piece to show we're all human, do we?
Sorry about the death of your family, but yes. But I thought I wouldn't replace the brake pads because, you know, to err is human, yeah.
some of the worst typos, I did a little bit of research on this, and some of the worst typos always seem to be the most unfortunate place in obituaries. And of course the classic one from Curb Your Enthusiasm, when Larry David, all I can say is the episode called Beloved Aunt, and there's a typo in the newspaper. I saw doing some research yesterday, I looked at some obituaries and there's one that's remembering a loved one that's gone and saying, and we'll all remember your genital face.
Oh, no.
Yes, which it must have been read out over the phone to the newspaper, and they actually printed your genital face. And another one where I saw this, I actually saw this in print, where it said, it was supposed to say, Dear Dad. As a sort of memory piece to their lost father. But the newspaper mixed up the R of the word dear, and so it read Dead Dad.
I know of a similar one that was published in a magazine called Community Care, which is a social work magazine. It was a recruitment advertisement, and at the bottom it said special arrangements will be made for the dead and hard of hearing.
Oh, God, yes. I had my last one is I saw some pharmacy instruction, the little labels that they put in the chemist to say, take five of these before retiring or whatever. Yeah. And it was meant to read, take one capsule before bed, but it actually read, take one capsule before dead. It's far more striking, isn't it?
Yeah, there's some really quaint ones, aren't there? I've seen a photo of one. You know, you get these giant cookies that you can have like a message written on in icing.
Yeah.
And somebody posted one on Twitter, and it said on it, congratulations on your graduation, and underneath that, love mum and dad. The actual words, and underneath that.
Yeah. I always remember a friend of mine when his daughter, who's now in her 30s, was a wee baby. I possibly mentioned this before. His mother-in-law, the child who was, as I say, just about 6 months old, spent the best part of 6 months knitting a jumper with the little girl's name on it, and she happily presented it over at the right time, the birthday or whatever, and it said JESSCIA, Jeskia, instead of Jessica.
Oh, she knitted it.
She'd knitted it, hand-stitched in all the lettering, but had spelt it J-E-S-S-C-I-A.
Oh, probably quite easy to do if you're knitting, because it's not writing, is it? You...
No, I know.
There's
a typo in the real world. I don't know if they actually said anything, or whether this poor kid had to actually walk around for a year being called Jeskia instead of Jeskia.
Yeah. I don't know if you suffer from this with... I'm sure you do with your surname, but I mean, I get emails all through the week with permutations of my first name of Magnus. Some of them misunderstand, misremember things, but also just typos. I get loads of Mangus emails.
Mangus, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, I get variations of Terence with two R's with an A. When Graham Nash signed my copy of his autobiography last year, he spelt it T-E-R-R-A-N-C-E.
Oh, no.
And I didn't have the heart. Yeah, I didn't have the heart to tell him. You know,
you clip him round here and say, "You idiot!"
Yeah, I know. You fool!
Lots of Mangus. And I had a neighbour in London many, many years ago who, all the time we lived next door to each other, she'd call me Megus.
Megus?
Yeah. I corrected her once and she said, "Oh, yes, sorry. And then the next time she called me Megus again, so I left it. Yeah.
Charlie Mingus.
An old friend of mine in London who also lived in the flat at the time still calls me Mingus to this day.
Lord. Well, you can imagine with the surname D-A-C-K-O-M-B-E, which I spell out all the time. And of course, people don't know how to pronounce it. So, if I'm waiting, I don't know, let's say at the dentist, it's Mr. Dacombe.
they probably think you're from West Africa or something.
It does. I'm sure I've said this before. It's like they sometimes said, like an African tribal chief, Mr. Dacombe. Dacombe.
All spelling was a sort of forgivable. And I guess if my name was Steve and I was communicating with a Magnus, I might well get it wrong myself. But the basics, like I say, the twos and the twos and the theirs and the theirs. Nobody. It strikes me nobody knows the difference between Y-O-U-R and Y-O-U apostrophe R-E anymore at all, anywhere. No. Certainly not online, they don't.
That's certainly true, and Twitter being one of the prime examples where that crops up.
All the time.
Well, let me spell out our next subject to you. That's good. YouTube is launching a subscription music service, which is apparently to rival Spotify, in that users will be able to watch and listen to music without commercials, and if they feel the need to do so, to download songs to mobile devices. However, it's been reported this week that labels that don't play nicely with YouTube will find their content unavailable on this new service, meaning perhaps that Adele and the Arctic Monkeys will be excluded from this YouTube music pass. Now, I don't think this service is particularly aimed at you, Magnus Shaw. However, do you think this is brinkmanship, hubris, or do you think it's sound business sense from YouTube?
I think Google are now used to getting their own way, so threatening artists with withdrawal if they don't play ball doesn't surprise me at all. I don't quite understand who is going to profit from this YouTube service. If all the music is free, if you can download it all on devices and you can access the platform for nothing, what's the point?
It's a subscription service. You have to pay to belong, like you do with Spotify.
I see. Okay. So the argument from the artists is that they're not going to see an appropriate proportion of these subscriptions.
Well, the money goes, as far as I understand it, the money actually goes to the labels, who then distribute it according to their own agreements with the artists. But because some of these independent labels, which also covers some big stars, say like Arctic Monkeys and Adele, haven't yet formed an agreement with YouTube about the percentages and how much and what content they get and so on, they're going to be excluded from this YouTube music pass.
Yeah.
But I think it's a ridiculous argument anyway, because this genie will never ever be returned to the bottle. Young people, they won't pay for this service, because although this subscription service won't feature the official feeds without ads in terms of the independent labels, this won't stop fans uploading content. So while you may not be able to see or hear Adele on the official channel, there'll be hundreds of alternative uploads by fans. And my experience and knowledge, in fact, is that young people don't even know, I suppose even less care, whether they're listening to Calvin Harris, 5 Seconds of Summer, Paloma Faith on an official channel or on one set up by a fan. They don't care.
No, of course they don't.
And most don't look at the video anyway. They're just listening while they're doing something else. It just happens to be on YouTube. Yeah. So rather like business with the BBC earlier, I rather fear it's executives of YouTube and major labels yet again clinging desperately, to the hope that the old model, you know, can still prosper.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's very telling that they've fallen to arguing about this, because this is exactly what happened over Napster, sort of 10-12 years ago, is that the industry fell to arguing and fell to lawyers and who's going to blink first and all the rest of it. And the lesson not learnt from that was that you were actually rejecting the technology that was going to take the industry forward, and they're just going to do it all over again now, because as you say, I mean, I think the days of drawing your income as a musician from the sales of your music are pretty much finished. And that is an amoral standpoint. You can say that that's a terrible thing. You can say that that's a great thing. It doesn't matter, because it is actually a thing.
Yeah, well, when the Beatles released Can't Buy Me Love, for example, there was no alternative. To hear the record on demand, you had to go to a shop and you had to buy it.
Exactly.
50 years later, if you want to hear a track released this week, this week's, you know, version of Can't Buy Me Love, if you like, you have countless options, the least sensible of which is actually to own it by purchasing it in physical form.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
but the industry... Yeah, exactly. Yet the industry on all sides fails to understand that the model for making money from recorded music belongs to that lost era of 1964.
Yes, yes. Well, the fact that major record labels do not have their own download platforms tells me everything I need to know. I mean, if you were the chair of a major record label, you would think that it would have occurred to you by now to sell the catalogue that you have over the internet via your own websites.
I think there's probably still executives in record labels still kind of thinking, well, one day record shops will return to a high street and everything will calm down and we'll be all right again.
Yeah, see, this is exactly the same mindset as these corporations maybe 15 years ago who fell about laughing when they were told that they need to buy a domain name and get a website set up. And they said, what would we need a website for? You know.
Meanwhile, everyone, the fuss will die down and everyone will continue to find new ways to access content for free. Life will carry on. Now, the Magda Shaw, you and Mrs. the Magda Shaw are what I like to call festival goers. Now, I can understand why you would go to a local event. I'm sure you can tell us about the Newark Festival that you're about to attend. But you also go to the Cornbury Do, which, if I'm right, sees you and poor Mrs. the Magda Shaw sleeping under canvas in a field.
Yeah, very nice.
With festival season upon us once more, is that terrible discomfort, and again, I'm thinking of poor Mrs. the Magna Shaw, is it balanced out by seeing Sam Bailey and the Gypsy Kings in the far distance?
Well, you see, your sympathies are misguided, because my good lady wife adores the whole thing.
Well, she's a hardy woman, isn't she?
She is. She has no objection at all to camping out in the field and trolling around the site in the heat and dust to watch various acts.
You've struck lucky there, Max. Yeah, well, you really have.
I'm the more reluctant party, and I don't really enjoy camping at all. I'm always delighted to get home and see a sofa and a bathtub, you know. I'm very much led by the nose, but it is really good fun when you get there, I have to say. It's exceptionally good fun. And if the weather's good, and last year the weather was impeccable, and it was like being in the Mediterranean, it's really enjoyable. So many artists to see, all within a reasonably short walk. The atmosphere is great, but I'm not, you see, you call me a festival goer, and I wouldn't go to any festival. In fact, I probably only go to Cornbury, because it is very relaxed and sort of family orientated and peaceable and safe and tranquil, and the setting is beautiful. It's in a gorgeous part of Oxfordshire. The idea of going to like Leeds Reading just fills me with dread. I used to go to the V Festival now and again, and we had this conversation the other week. I was thinking of going this year because I really like the lineup, but they were having a laugh with the tickets. Plus, I know that you are treated like cattle at the V Festival, so it's only really Cornbury that I go to. And but
this local event down the road tomorrow.
Well, see,
this
is the solution for wusses like your good self. Is to go to the one day event. Which is I'm going to tomorrow, because there's no canvas, no pots and pans, no thermos flasks necessary. You turn up and you enjoy the event and then you come home again. And now I have to say that is much more my taste.
Yeah, me too.
But I do enjoy Cornbury, and as I say, Mrs. the Magna Shaw absolutely adores it. It's one of the highlights of her summer. So I have no... To suggest that we skip Cornbury would be absolutely heresy in my household. So
I think the only way that I could enjoy, in inverted commas, the festival is I would go for the VIP model, the private loos, somewhere to go and sit down and maybe stay in a local hotel. I think that would
like
be...
stay in a local hotel. As you can imagine, even with a festival the size of Cornbury, every hotel within a 30-mile radius is A, booked up, and B, has tripled their prices over that weekend. So,
that's typical.
I mean, my niece lives not far from Cornbury. Well, 10 miles or so from Cornbury. We could stay at her house, but
get on your little scooter in you go, but you choose.
We have to be on site.
People buy Glastonbury tickets each year without knowing who's going to headline, don't they? This often works out okay when it turns out to be the Stones or Coldplay, but this year they've imposed Metallica upon those who bought tickets, which I think is a bit of a niche interest. They must have a limited appeal. I would think there's a fair few people that paid whatever you pay these days, a couple of hundred quid, I suppose, for Glastonbury, and then Metallica.
It is an odd pick, isn't it? It's
not their brightest year overall. They've got Metallica, Arcade Fire, and Kasabian.
No, that sound more like Leeds Reading than Glastonbury, doesn't it? Yes. Curious.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose. Well, I think it laps itself, doesn't it? They're booking up Glastonbury 2015, aren't they, now, before 2014 has taken place. And I suppose all the organisers put their feelers out, see who they can and or are likely to get. Glastonbury must be a big hitter, but to an extent, you have to you can't have a band playing at three festivals all at the same time. So you have to sort of, to an extent, take what you can get, I suppose. But, yeah, Metallica don't strike me as being the quintessential Glastonbury band.
No, I would just been thinking, yeah, if you're booking up for a year ahead or whatever, you know, I appreciate that, you know, you can't have the Stones because they were last year and, you know, Springsteen's, you know, done a couple of years in a row at Hyde Park and so on and so forth. So, you know, you've got to kind of scale around a bit. But surely there must have been somebody on the kind of global headliner set that's available and with a wider appeal.
Yeah,
I may be proved wrong. Yeah. You know, maybe they'll go down a storm. But
yes, Metallica certainly have a big audience, but they're a very specific audience. You don't get many people who say, "I like a little bit of Metallica," do they?
No.
I don't mind a bit of Metallica. You know, either you're all Metallica'd up or you're not. I suppose that's I agree that the wide appeal isn't there. I mean, much more Glastonbury-like to, I don't know, have McCartney maybe, or even look like Lady Gaga would have been perhaps quite good.
Well, Metallica certainly couldn't be described as folk art, and the term folk art is an open door for pretension, where naively hewn pieces of wood or hastily assembled plastic cheap metallic banners are lionized by Sood's Corner critics who purr over the peasant creativity. Oh, look at this delightful artisan bench, darling. Childlike simplicity can be an endearing attribute, but as the old saying goes, is it art? On Tuesday, BBC Two's Culture Show tried to bring some clarity by engaging Jeremy Deller and Alan Kane to guide us to a greater understanding of folk art. And we both watched this programme. Did this 30-minute insight inflame you with a passion for old boots on a shelf?
Yeah, my immediate concern is the name The Culture Show, and it has been since its inception. I can't think of the name for a programme strand that could be more exclusive than The Culture Show. I really truly believe people scan down the schedule, see something called The Culture Show, and take it upon themselves to think, well, that isn't for me, and it may well be an ironic title, but that doesn't really help. I'd dearly love for that particular program to be called anything other than The Culture Show. So that said, this particular episode, I suppose it was well-intentioned in that it was trying to point out the fact that art is all around us. But this raises the question that if two fellows, and this was, as you say, presented by two artists, come through Blackpool, point to a giant plastic hot dog and say, oh, that couldn't be more pop art. That's the most pop art thing I've ever seen. Then presumably we can walk down any street and point to almost anything man-made and ascribe it the title of some kind of the category of art, in which case everything becomes art and art becomes everything and it all becomes pointless. So I'm not really sure what the proposition was.
I thought it's a wasted opportunity. There was the bloke who essentially paints motorbikes and motorcycle helmets, and he said, I made a note of what he said. He said, "I don't call it art. I just call it having fun painting." Mm. And really, you know, they could have saved the whole premise of the program by just coming on at the beginning and saying, "Hey, everybody, what folk art is everybody just having fun doing art?" And then we could have looked at cartoons for half an hour.
Well, yes, it struck me that the two artists who were anchoring this in a very unscripted and therefore quite uninteresting way actually wanted to argue with people like the motorcycle painter, and when he said this isn't art, it's just having fun painting and getting paid for it, they were sort of adamant that it was. No, you're wrong, it is art. you are an artist. And he didn't really want to be an artist, and neither really did anybody else that they spoke to. And whilst of course, you know, an exhibition of advertising through the ages, he has, you know, cultural and social significance, of course it does. You don't really need a television program to say, look at this vintage advertising, isn't it interesting? Because of course it is, it's interesting to most people, and particularly to designers or typographers. But I didn't know what they were revealing to us. What were they showing us that we didn't know?
It had no structure at all. The two chaps, Della and Kane, wandering into Tate Britain, reading way too much into old street signs. You know, these were, you know, things that just people put a boot up in the window to show that they were a shoe menders. You know, and people wrote things on bits of metal because they wanted to write something on metal. They weren't, you know, trying to give some sort of spiritual message.
No,
they sort of looked at things and then read the nameplate out to us, which I thought, you know, well, I could go to Tate Britain and do that. But as you say, yes, going to Blackpool, which they actually called the spiritual home of folk art, where every day is May Day, and we just saw them wandering into shops selling joke items and Kiss Me Quick hats. You know, this is folk art. The only thing that they went the only thing that maintained my interest for a few seconds, they went to next door to Wormwood Scrubs to look at proper art created by prisoners, and there was this bloke called Manny Frimpong who was a prisoner, and he explained how being in prison motivated him to create quite marvellous portraits and caricatures. I mean, that had really very little to do with what they were trying to do. No, I thought it was a pointless programme.
Yes, but I actually thought the same as you, that there's your programme, is art in prison. Mm. There's an interesting programme, prisoner art, but not presented by these two layabouts, you know, presented by somebody, you know, like Will Gompertz or somebody who's got a real feeling for their subject and a worthy subject, because it struck me that everything was folk art to these guys and therefore nothing was folk art. So I'd absolutely got to the end and thought, I have no understanding now, further understanding of folk art, because you haven't revealed anything to me.
It took me back to my history of art A level, which is several decades ago now, and one question it was simply this. It was the official board A level, and it said the question was simply this: a child of five could have done it. Discuss. And there was no example given. That was the whole question.
It is an interesting question, and I mean I really am of that sort of conservative or ignorance school of art criticism, and the art that impresses me is art that I couldn't do. If in a million years I couldn't produce what I'm looking at, I'm already starting to be impressed. But if I'm looking at it and say and think, yes, I could do that, and I you know, have very little artistic skill, then I immediately start to lose interest. I'd like to see things that people can do that I can't.
So Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin's oeuvre aren't
no,
aren't
I don't
for
like,
you.
Don't like it. Don't like either of them. But I do like Roy Lichtenstein, for instance, just for an example. Mm. Actually, Tracy Emin's Ink on Paper work, I think, is staggeringly good, and I wish that's what she did. I wish that she did all her work was like that, because I couldn't do that. That ability to put seven lines on a piece of paper and it looks like a figure reclining on a sofa just blows me away, because I can't do that. And I'm all, you know, it's always impressive to watch somebody do something that you can't do. When you look at a Vermeer, you've cross that boundary by a country mile, haven't you? But when you look at some dots that a student of Damien Hirst did on his behalf, I couldn't give a monkey's.
I don't know much about art, but I know what.
Well, it's
a
terrible
like.
Cliche, but I think I probably do come close to that category. Yes, yes.
This was Tuesday, 10 o'clock, BBC Two, the Culture Show, presented by Jeremy Della and Alan Kane, and it was produced and directed by Rosie Schellenberg. Okay. This is a surprise, but I'm getting a message here, Megan Shaw, that Fern Cotton.
I'm leaving.
The internet
the whole internet, yes.
Yeah. Luis Suarez from Uruguay and Adele. They've all been on the phone saying, well, we agree with you about the culture show, so could you please move on to the pretend iPod? Coincidentally, they've all phoned in at the same time and said that. Remarkable thing. Pretend iPod. What's going to happen here is that Magna Shore and I are going to tell you about a piece of music we like, and then we're going to tell you why, and then it's going to join a cavalcade, a parade, a marching band of a playlist that appears on the Rocking Vicar website that you can listen to if you want to. You can listen to all of it, you can listen to one of it, you can listen to some of it. You can do what you like.
You can just do what the hell you like.
Do what you like, and you can also listen to it directly on Spotify and under the name of this very fellow here. There he is, Magnus Shaw.
Yeah.
So, Magnus Shaw, in relation to this so-called pretend iPod, what on earth have you got up your sleeve this week?
Well, I've actually picked a very obscure artist from Uruguay. I'm just really intrigued with your pronunciation of that.
Uruguay?
Yeah, is that right? Uruguay, is it? It's not Uruguay, Uruguay then.
Well, that's how they say it.
Okay, yeah, well, very good. No, I haven't picked an obscure artist.
Oh, you were just having us on.
Now, I know it's heresy in some quarters, but believe it or not, I was never completely bowled over by the Smiths. I know I'm supposed to be, you know, as a something of a music connoisseur, I'm supposed to, you know, worship at the altar of the Smiths, but it never quite took on me. In fact, I genuinely prefer Morrissey's solo stuff. I think he's done some much better stuff on his own. I know they'll be at my front door with flaming torches before I finish the next sentence, but I do accept that nevertheless there must be something exceptional about the band, because they do attract this continued level of adoration which shows no sign of fading and probably will last for all eternity. And I think I can just about glean a morsel of what these devotees are on with when I listen to the song How Soon Is Now. But funnily enough, it's probably the least Smith-sounding Smith single that they ever released. And I think that's probably because it's really Johnny Marr's record more than it is Stephen Patrick Morrissey's. From that unmistakable chugging introduction, which, you know, a fraction of a second of that, you know the record you're about to hear. Right through to those soaring and howling hooks. I mean, Johnny Marr is having an absolute festival on this track. Marr's guitar is like dominating every corner of the song. Wisely, and he's no fool, you Morrissey. He doesn't try to compete with his right hand man having this decade of birthdays in terms of his guitar work. Instead, he lets his vocals ride over those waves of reverb and psychedelic echo that Marr's creating alongside. It's really truly unique thing, and in fact, I can go as far as to say it's a record that sounds completely like any other record I've heard. And that includes all the Smiths records that I've heard. Perhaps that's why I love it so much. And perhaps that's why I've chosen it for the pretend iPod this week. It's the Smiths. How Soon Is Now?
Is there sort of, I mean this in a good way, they're sort of Bohemian Rhapsody. They're sort of, I think the peak of their performance. I love this track, and I mainly for the Johnny Marr guitar work on it. It's absolutely fantastic. I just got diverted there. So I was just checking to see if it has been a hit in Uruguay. I think I only say that to be pretentious. In real life, I do say Uruguay.
Right, I should. I like Uruguay. Yeah.
I just like saying it. You know. Is that? No. It's a great track. Old Morrissey. His health is cause for concern. He keeps cancelling tours.
Well, he's got a cold.
Well, he's got a cold, but if it's a cold, it's meant he's cancelled his entire American tour, leaving Cliff Richard high and dry. Because Cliff was going over there to be the support for the gig in New York.
I have no more knowledge, inside knowledge, than anybody else, but what I took from it was that the support band had pulled up all with colds, which he'd caught.
Oh.
And he was in a fit of pique. He was so annoyed that the support band were infectious that he can't hold a shooting match. Not so much that he didn't think his cold would recover in time, but to teach them a lesson, you know.
Oh dear! I mean, I do feel sorry to go off at a tangent. I do feel sorry for Cliff because you know this was this must have made his year, his decade, and you know to think he was going to be appearing with Morrissey, and it's so sad because he was so excited about going out to New York to support Morrissey. He's still going ahead and he's doing a little gig out there for free for all his American fans.
Good. Well, I mean, there's no reason why that Morrissey hookup won't happen. Happen again in the future.
I hope it does.
But you know what Morrissey's like for throwing tantrums, and I think that's exactly what's happened. He pulled and he was annoyed about it, you know.
Dear, oh dear. But it's a great track, and it's the one to endorse it further. It's the one I would have chosen myself had I you know had to pick a my best Smith song.
Yeah.
Now. Let me choose something a little more up-to-date, which for me means a record released in January 1967 and recorded a month before in Hollywood. January 1967, the New York Times reported that the U.S. Army was conducting secret germ warfare experiments. This while the war in Vietnam raged on, and as a counter to that, and the draft, at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, the Human Bee-In.
I'm familiar with the Human Bee-In. In fact, I drove past the site of the Human Bee-In 2 years ago.
Well, it's generally seen, then, as you will know, as the sort of first flower petal fluttering in the heady air of the upcoming Summer of Love. Initially, the Human Bee-In, it was organized as a protest about LSD being declared as illegal in California in October 1966. Quite remarkable to think that up until then it was perfectly legal to be with your LSD But this movement, the Bee-In, it grew into a union of love and activism. And meanwhile, just down the coast in Los Angeles, just arrived with his friend Richie Furay, was a 21-year-old Stephen Stills. And as is well known now, Furay and Stills were stuck in a traffic line on Sunset Boulevard when they saw Neil Young in his black Pontiac hearse. They flagged him down, and the first supergroup was born, really, Buffalo Springfield. In November 1966, Stephen Stills witnessed an evening of civil unrest at the corner of Sunset Boulevard and Crescent Heights. The rock nightclub, Pandora's Box, was closed down, and Jack Nicholson, Peter Fonda, and about 1,000 young people turned up to protest against a curfew imposed following lobbying by local residents and business owners. And over time, what actually happened that night, it depends on your viewpoint. Either the cops overreacted and beat up several young people, or some protesters got carried away, smashed up a bus, and the police were forced to intervene. In the Los Angeles Times, Stephen Stills said, "It wasn't a riot, it was a funeral for Pandora's Box, but it looked like a revolution." And that was, I think, the point. Stephen Stills' subsequent song about this turbulent time, about the trouble on Sunset Boulevard, became the anthem that heralded that summer of hope in 1967. Battle lines being drawn, young people speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. Everybody look what's going down. Lyndon B. Johnson in the White House. "Hey, hey, LBJ. How many kids have you killed today?" We used to go round marching, singing in the late 60s. Young American boys, it's incredible to think of this. Young American boys were being killed in Vietnam at the rate of 1,000 per month.
Yeah.
Extraordinary when you think about it, isn't it? Everybody look what's going down. Recorded December the 5th, 1966, at Gold Star Recording Studio, Hollywood. It was released January the 9th, 1967. No entry in the UK Top 40, but number 7 on the Billboard Hot 100. 2 minutes, 37 seconds, Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth.
I just love the idea that it was a time in Los Angeles when you could pull up at the lights next to Neil Young driving a hearse. And then later that evening, be trolling along Sunset and see Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda protesting outside a nightclub.
I so agree. What a time that must have been. Isn't it amazing?
Yes, it is. If you had a good day, anything exceptional happen? Not really. Saw Neil Young driving a hearse and Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda rioting outside a club, but other than that, no, nothing really. Yeah.
I think they recognised, they knew he had a hearse, but I think they recognised the Canadian number plate on the car. I mean, can imagine doing that on Sunset now. you'd be pulled over by a cop anyway, saying, what are you stopping for?
That's right. Amazing times, and I think, that's it, gave rise to lots of amazing music. But particularly that. So I really like its sort of understatedness. It has a bit of sort of sinister vibe.
Yes, it does.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you can feel it. Something awful's going to happen. It does have apprehension to it, doesn't it?
Brilliantly described. That's what is exactly what I was trying to portray there. That's exactly it. It has an air of, look out, what's happening here?
Yeah, it really does. You take like the Scott McKenzie's San Francisco, which is. He's very sort of positive and light and airy, isn't it? And the flower children are here and everything's going to be all right. But for what it's worth, is sort of the other side of that coin. It's like if we're not careful, something dreadful is going to happen. Great. Yeah, it's a really good record. Really, really good record. So two sterling items up on the shelf labelled pretend iPod. And hold on, I think I can see the number 63 to Peckham High Street approaching. So I better dig out my travel pass and say a quick thanks to Terence Dackham for his exceptional work.
Be seeing you.
And Rona Martin for her vocal talents at the top of this podcast. And of course, to you, you are our favourite listener. There's always more at therockingvicar.com. But until next time, bye bye.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Being wrong, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. A field day for the heat, a thousand people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shaw Media production.
Which means a better outcome for everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes my presentation on the Healthy Homes and Hospitals Programme, or HHH. Any questions?
How'd you say your acronym again?
It's HHH.
Thought so.
Shot Ian.
It's pronounced H, not H. H.
You can't shoot him just for that.
I just did. Anyway, it's my company. I can do what I like.
But we all signed the No Bullying in the Workplace pledge, which specifically bans physical violence.
What did you say?
I said it specifically bans physical violence.
It's specifically, with an S, specifically.
Bloody hell, Tony. Will you stop shooting people for saying things wrong?
You, what are you drinking?
Oh, coffee.
What type?
It's an espresso.
The word is espresso.
Stop it, Tony.
Oh, come on, Luke. You know very well I killed my own wife for ironically saying mispronunciation. If I apply rigorous standards at home, I see no reason why the same standards shouldn't apply in the workplace.
Why do you have to shoot them? Why can't you just sack them?
I never thought of that. Yes, I suppose I could. It's just the red mist tends to descend whenever I'm confronted with ignoramus.
Actually, Tony, I think you'll find it's ignoramuses.
What?
It's from the Latin, we are ignorant. That makes it a verb, not a noun.
Oh, no. What have I done?
Blimey. At least that'll stop him shooting whoever he likes.
It's whomever.